When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome, dear listeners. I'm Jonathan Carlin.
Oh, and I'm Ben Carlin. I forgot I had a part.
You do. And we invite you to join us through the Gryffindor, your one-way ticket to the enchanting world of Harry Potter. So grab your wands, dust off your broomsticks, and join us as we unlock the secrets behind Philosopher's Stone, Chapter 7, The Sorting Hat.
I gotta say, I feel like, because we started just right in chaotic.
But
I feel like it's very fitting because the chapter art for The Sorting Hat
is... Yeah, let's talk about that one just immediately.
Because it is remarkably... not the hat.
It is. Yeah, I wrote down. I literally, like, before I even finished chapter 6, I looked over and was like, what is this? I wrote terrible art to chapter name. The chapter art, in case you're wondering, depicts Peeves holding the walking sticks, looking all angry and floating up in the air. But, like, one, the chapter is called The Sorting Hat. And The Sorting Hat and the act of being sorted into Gryffindor for Harry is one of the most significant moments in all of wizarding history. Not just, like, in this book. Like, of the... And this is a huge monumental moment. So that the chapter art is not the hat or Harry wearing the hat. Like, it is... terrible. And then not only that, on top of that, the picture of Peeves is also a terrible picture of Peeves.
Yeah.
It's like he's not even like funny.
I know. Like he's not nearly like whimsical enough. Like he just seems like actually like a mean creature.
Right.
And that's not how Peeves is. So,
right. He should look like everything is a joke.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So we'll come back I can go deep into Peeves, as we get closer.
I know
to
you
the,
can.
The poltergeist
yes.
Lore there. But so this was like one of those things where I did write Peeves. Who is also famously not in the films.
At all.
Probably just like one of those things that was just like too hard to incorporate as like an additional detail. But either which way, I feel like the Sorting Hat is highly depictable. It feels like there's really no excuse. Like I know a lot of times it's like there's a little bit of caution being added towards the chapter art, like not being too much of like a giveaway. But like quite literally,
it's called the Sorting Hat.
It's called the Sorting Hat. It's like even though in this chapter, like we will be mildly more informed than the characters themselves about how the sorting is going to go down. Like we already know it's going to be a hat. So anyway, just show us the hat.
The hat is
such a cool thing. So anyway, but that being said, I felt like there was no way to not talk about it first things first.
We
enter this chapter.
Although I will say then before we dive too far in that I have some other, I know last week we were number one on the books podcast in Sweden, if you recall.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Shout out to Sweden.
Yeah. What up, Sweden? Sweden. Well, I was looking through the charts today, and we are presently number three in Sweden. So there is that. However, Ben, we are number one in books in Lebanon.
Lebanon!
What's up? Perhaps you've heard of us. We're kind of a big deal in Lebanon.
Yeah. This would be like the new running gag for the show. It's just like, which country are we the number one on books in this week?
We're number three in America.
Okay.
So that's pretty good. I'll take that. I mean, yeah, way to go to all of our listeners out there. I'm just, you know, I am just proud of our audience for boosting through the Gryffindor to the number three book slot.
It's pretty cool. Just a little United bit of a sophomore States. Slump for Sweden. That's all.
You know, they'll be back. Look, if you're a Swedish listener, just go through right now. Just, you know, give it a rating, give it a review. Maybe we'll read it next time. Make sure you include "I'm from Sweden" in your review, and that I promise you, if there's a variety, I'll pick one of them. But if there's not, I'll still pick the "I'm from Sweden" one.
Okay.
There you go.
There we go.
Yeah, all right, we'll get to the review later. Anyway, let's talk about the chapter itself.
Yes.
The sorting out. Mainly what happens is the first years arrive into the Great Hall, and they go through the sorting ceremony, and that is the most. We are introduced to Snape for the first time from afar, although the next chapter is called The Potions Master, so we're going to get a full-on introduction there, and Harry sees Dumbledore for the first time, and that's the gist of what happens in this chapter, but there is still a lot to unpack.
Oh my gosh, yeah, it's just like endless amounts and lots of like really cool, like I think ideas and stuff, but
yeah.
Kind of first and foremost, so we can kind of get the ball rolling here, is the fact that of all people, both Ron and Hermione are both unaware of what the sorting ceremony actually entails.
It is very unusual. That, yes, no one, even Malfoy, doesn't seem like he knows how the sorting is going to go.
Yes, and so, like, you get, like, a little bit of, like, a suggestion from Ron, sort of on behalf of Fred and George, where Ron says the line, like, some sort of test, I think. Fred said it hurts a lot, but I think he was joking. And, like, you know, when you know the Weasleys, and then, like, even, like, especially the more you get to know the Weasleys, it wouldn't surprise you in the slightest that Fred and George were just trying to, like, mess with Ron.
Yeah.
But then, like, in addition to that, like, you know, Hermione knows that, like, that the ceiling of the Great Hall is enchanted because she read about it in Hogwarts of History. And it's like, how on earth is it possible that Hogwarts of History does not make reference to the Sorting Hat?
Right, like it really does not track. But Hermione doesn't know how it's going to go either, because it says Hermione Granger was whispering very fast about all the spells she'd learned and wondering which one she'd need. And it's like, you're right. It's like there is no way that Hermione doesn't know, and there's no way that Hogwarts of History doesn't mention the Sorting Hat. And like I mean, sure, maybe Fred and George were messing with Ron, but like they're not his only older brothers, you know? He's the sixth Weasley to be going. There's no way the Sorting Hat has not come up in his life.
Well, so this is like where I always think it's kind of interesting, because I feel like there's a decent possibility that the Sorting Hat is quite literally under like its own Fidelius charm.
I subscribe to that theory so hard.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Because there is this sort of like really, really unusual like nature about how the fact that the Sorting Hat is never ever discussed with incoming students prior to their sorting, which means that like as students you are supposed to come in, enter the sorting, and it's like a piece of information that you can know but not share,
right.
I think is what it comes down to.
It's like until the hat, like the way the Fidelius charm would work in this scenario is very similar to like how it's concealed within Grimald Place,
right,
where Dumbledore is the secret keeper of the headquarters of the Order of the Phoenix, which in book 5 is Grimald, number 12, Grimald Place.
Right.
Whilst Dumbledore is alive, he has to tell each individual person the secret of where it is. And then those people know the information, but they can't tell anybody else about it.
Right.
So that's how the hat would have to work. It seems like the hat is under a Fidelius charm where like it itself is the one who has to tell you the secret of itself.
Yeah, either that or somehow it's like a pass from headmaster to headmaster type of...
Well, but it's not Dumbledore who tells them about it. Like, it is... And I don't think McGonagall says... tells them about the hat ahead of time either. She just, like, puts the hat on the stool and then the hat begins to sing. She doesn't, like, give them instructions. Like, everyone's going to put on the hat next.
Right. She even says like before they enter the Great Hall, it says the sorting ceremony will take place in a few minutes in front of the rest of the school. I suggest you all smarten yourselves up as much as you can while you are waiting.
Yeah.
Which if anything almost seems to further suggest that like this is the type of thing where you're about to need to like place put on some kind of a performance or put your skills on
right.
display.
Yeah. And then leading up to it, it says, Harry quickly looked down again, Professor McGonagall, as Professor McGonagall silently placed a four-legged stool in front of the first years. On top of the stool, she put a pointed wizard's hat. The hat was patched and frayed and extremely dirty. And like no one says anything else, the hat just begins singing. So it seems like the way it's working is that no one can tell you about the hat. The hat must tell you about the hat.
But I think that this is so vital. I mean, even if you were the founders devising this exact concept, because you don't want students coming into school with like, I mean, they may know like which house that they like would prefer or something right. like that. They might know the houses their parents were in, but like they don't know how to prepare for what sorting will be like.
Right.
And therefore it's sort of like you don't like you'll know for 35 seconds prior to your moment what's about to happen. The interesting exclusion to this where we do eventually get a commentary about the hat prior to sorting is when Harry
in the epilogue.
So literally we're going from, you know, chapter 7 of book 1 to not even the last chapter of the series, but the epilogue of the series where Harry is talking to his son,
Albus,
and basically says like the sorting hat takes into consideration like what you want, or at least it did for me. And what's interesting about this is that like normally with the Fidelius Charm and Dumbledore, for example, in Grimmauld Place, is that upon Dumbledore's death, everybody who then had been told the location would now be able to share the location because they would become new secret keepers right. themselves, which dilutes the power of the Fidelius Charm. But I think like what happens at the Battle of Hogwarts is Voldemort summons
the sorting hat
from the headmaster's office, which he then plants on top of Neville's head and then lights it on fire.
Right. So what, like the way the theory would go is that when he does this, he effectively kills the sorting hat.
Yes.
And like destroys the Fidelius Charm.
Well, it destroys it to the tune of now everybody who knows about the sorting hat
is now a secret keeper.
Right. Meaning anybody who has ever been sorted before is now capable of talking about
right.
it.
Right. Yeah. So conceivably, if it's still true, Harry could tell Albus about the sorting hat, but then Albus could not tell other people.
That is possible.
Until he has been sorted, I guess. Right?
Maybe? Depending on how they revive the sorting hat after the fact,
right.
I think would be the answer to that question.
Right, you're right, yeah. Okay, I don't know how it would go from there. But the point is, there is a loophole wherein Harry should be able to tell Albus about the sorting hat because Voldemort destroys the initial Fidelius Charm.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. So,
but prior to that is like the only explanation to me for why it's not in Hogwarts of History and why Ron himself doesn't know about it.
Right, yeah, because I mean, Ron would literally be what, you know, he's got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 brothers ahead of him and two parents, all of whom have been through the ceremony. Yeah, it's like this is never come up around the dinner table before at any point in time. Like, but what I love about that though is that there's like a completely in-universe explanation that's also kind of cool.
Yeah, it is very cool.
It's like you can look at this as sort of like a loophole or a plot hole or something like that. But instead, I think it's just like you just got to find the clever explanation. And in my mind, that's my own personal.
Oh yeah, absolutely, so, absolutely. I think that's pretty fun. And we know that the Fidelius Charm can be broken by powerful spells because that's exactly what happens to the Potter's house, which ironically also by Voldemort.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Exactly. yep. So that's exactly right. The other kind of interesting thing here that I found is like another one of those little bit of like an interesting inconsistency is the stool itself. I think that in Prisoner of Azkaban, and I went through and I was trying to fact check this a little bit, and it seems like things have also been like edited throughout the years. But I think when Flitwick brings out the stool for the sorting ceremony in Prisoner, it's a three-legged stool, it has once been described as a three-legged stool, and it's since been corrected to be a four-legged stool. But this is kind of funny because I am absolutely certain that in J versus Ben trivia before, we have had the question before, how many legs are on the stool? And it basically is like, it pretty much has to be three or four.
Yeah.
That's kind of like one of those things where it's like, was that like an inconsistency that was like covered up? Is there any like other reason about a three-legged stool that like it wouldn't be the correct kind of stool or anything?
I think the reason, like if you wanted to back, I don't know. So are you saying that it did say three in here?
Been corrected. If you go to the latest copy of Prisoner of Azkaban, it says four in here, and it says four now in Prisoner of Azkaban. But there are reports online that at one point in time, Prisoner described a three-legged stool.
Oh, okay. That seems backwards. I can see, I could have argued towards like it being a three-legged stool here and have been a four-legged stool in Prisoner. Solely because the three-legged stool could then represent Gryffindor, Ravenclaw, and Hufflepuff.
Okay.
And like would omit the, and would be three-legged because Slytherin had split from the school. And then after Chamber of Secrets, the Chamber of Secrets like lore would have been resolved, at which point the stool could have four legs again because like the school would no longer be split by that particular mystery, which was what happened upon Slytherin splitting from the school. But apparently it's backwards, so I don't think that actually tracks.
I know. No, that's very interesting. But while you're on that exact note, I think it's a perfect time to jump just a little bit ahead and we can always jump back.
Yeah.
There is, of course, the opening feast sentiment from Mr. Albus Dumbledore, and it feels like pure chaos, but I'm going to let you explain it. So the famous line is, nitwit, blubber, oddment, tweak.
Yes. So he says his complete nonsense words, and Harry and everyone applauds, and Harry's like, what was that about? Is he mad? And he asks Percy the prefect, and I love that he's continuously listed as Percy the prefect. We made a video about this random line of dialogue once upon a time about like what on earth does he mean here, and our own explanation is that each word, nitwit, blubber, oddment, and tweak, are all meant to be represent the opposing ideals of each house. So, for example, a nitwit would be like the opposite of Ravenclaw.
Yeah, where a nitwit might suggest like lacking in intelligence,
right,
or smarts.
So then blubber, we said was this. I went back and reread our own script, so that's sort of what I'm going from here. But we said blubber would represent the opposite of a Gryffindor, meaning someone who is maybe like blubber just means fat. So that's perhaps like a word 11-year-old might use to put down someone who is like less athletic, which if you're in Gryffindor, they are like a little bit more bold and daring. So it's like athletics might be something they would take very seriously. And by might, I mean there actually is a line from Snape where he tells Harry that if his Quidditch team loses, it'll be the first time Gryffindor finished at the bottom of the table in 200 years. So like, it is definitely a house that takes athletics seriously, because that means Gryffindor has never finished less than third in a four-team contest in two centuries.
In two centuries, yeah. And there's additionally like the layer we get from Nearly Headless Nick that Slytherin has won the House Cup for how many years in a row now?
It is 6 years in a row.
6 years in a row. But yeah. I think that it's interesting to note that I think it's they have not won the House, or they've won the House Cup 6 years running, but I think that at least while Charlie Weasley was on the
Gryffindor Quidditch team,
it means that Gryffindor has won the Quidditch Cup more recently.
More recently than the House Cup. Although, yeah. I guess they're I would suspect that usually who wins the Quidditch Cup also wins the House Cup, but it's not always
mirrored. Okay. That's true. That's true.
Next up, we said that I almost disagree with our past selves here. We said oddment. It means a remnant part of something, like left over from a larger piece or set, which is no longer useful. So like if you had like a large piece of cloth and all that was left were a few scraps that weren't really functional or anything, those would be the oddments. So our argument in our video was that an oddment would be the opposite of Slytherin, who as far as the books or Dumbledore go, would view the Slytherins as really valuing pure bloodedness. So i.e. if you're like a half-blood or any fraction of magicalness that isn't 100%, you are an oddment and not worthy of magical education. But I would almost think you could also argue oddment for Hufflepuff, because she took the oddments.
I kind of see what you mean. That's sort of like the entire mantra of Hufflepuff House, is that they're just sort of like the like open-armed, you know, group. It's sort of like everybody's welcome here,
right?
So then
tweak, of course, would be left for Hufflepuff, at least in our initial video. So Hufflepuffs are like loyal and hardworking and humble and down to earth. So from their point of view, they may think the value placed on things like courage or wit or cunning by the other three houses were a little excessive and needs to be tweaked.
Tweaked. Okay.
So
interesting.
But then the point of it, as often is the case with Dumbledore, is that like it's not about like the differences between the houses, the the school functions best when the houses are all like supporting one another and it's more of like a unified thing. So the idea would be that look at these funny, look, these are words that anyone in your house might use to describe the members of the other houses.
Sure.
So like if you're in Gryffindor, you might call the Ravenclaws nitwits as like an insult or something.
Like a way to like needle them specifically.
Right.
Supposedly that would be the way to get through to them or something.
Yeah. Right. Like, but the point is that Dumbledore is trying to make, at least according, you know, our theory is that he's saying these things. It's like, look, the irony is that all of you might think of these words to describe the other houses, and yet you're all doing it because you're all actually the same.
Yes. Right. Yes, I love it. I love it. And it's another one of these things where, like, I feel like Dumbledore sort of has this, like, kind of constant air of whimsy. I feel like it hails back to the fact that he, you know, again, uses, like, candy as, like, his passwords for all mm-hmm. of his, you know, to get into, you know, his office and stuff like that. Like, it comes across as, like, a little bit of, like, silliness, which I think we see even more of, you know, further on in the chapter when they sing the school song. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, like, it's like one of these things where, like, Dumbledore almost seems to, like, be like, at your own pace,
yeah.
which is, like, usually not the way that you sing songs.
Oh,
it's,
yeah.
It's, like, at the rhythm that the song is supposed to be sung. And then, of yeah. course, you know, Fred and George just fully lean into,
The funeral march,
yeah, which, you know, they're just going at like a painfully slow.
I know. I wrote like a little note next to the song, which I don't think ever comes up again, like in any of the other opening feasts. It's not like, all right, and now it's time to sing the song or anything like that. But my note is that my headcanon is that I like to think that Godric and Salazar are the ones who wrote the lyrics to the song together.
Okay.
And like they just kept coming up with like, because it's very silly. And I like to think that they were just coming up with like silly things like, we need a school song. And Helga and Rowena were over there like, you guys, I don't like it. They're like, no. Here's the fun part. Here's the fun part, guys. You can sing it to any tune at all. That's right. The fun part. That's what makes it so whimsical. And they're like, okay, well.
This goes back to like our favorite headcanon, which is just simply that the friendship between Godric and Sal, as we always like to call them,
Sal,
is nothing but like jovial and it's like the friendship everybody has always wanted. It's like fully founded on mutual respect and humor and talent and like regard
exactly.
and respect. And it's like, so the idea in our
which
minds,
is what the Sorting Hat says. It says like Salazar and like it asks of the school, were there ever better friends than Gryffindor and Slytherin, unless it was the other two of Ravenclaw and Hufflepuff?
Right.
Yeah.
Even the fact that there's the line in the original song from the Sorting Hat that says, or yet in wise old Ravenclaw, which I was like, you know, it's kind of interesting to me that it regards Ravenclaw as wise and old, which, I mean, you would assume on some level that these were some of the most powerful witches and wizards of ever. So they probably lived like nice long lives and stuff like that. But for Ravenclaw to receive those accolades specifically of wise and old, makes me feel like there's a decent possibility that Ravenclaw is like a fair bit older than the other founders as they're founding.
Right.
Which I don't know if I have anything like really interesting in terms of
or just more, because the way the Sorting Hat was formed was that Gryffindor took the hat off his head, which I like to think all the founders made fun of him for because it's very silly looking.
No, but he like sported it and he's like, it's totally working.
My headcanon is that he came back from like a farmer's market type village shop one day and is sporting the hat and is like, guys, what do you think? And they all look at him and just immediately begin making fun of him. And he's like, I'm keeping it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then it goes on to be the Sorting Hat, which is fantastic. So if anyone wants, you know, me and Ben to write a founder series one day, we're open to it. And I have a million ideas about how it would go. But in any case, wise old Ravenclaw, eventually they need a way to sort the students in the houses after they are gone. So Gryffindor takes the Sorting Hat off of his head and they each put a little bit of themselves in there. So to me, this is just more of like them just like teasing one another. It's like, Like I can imagine, even if they're all like in their mid-20s or something, that they always refer to like Rowena as like, oh, wise old Ravenclaw over there.
Oh yeah, that, I can see that too. Yeah,
like really bothers her because she's so prim and proper.
Right. Like it's almost like she's not actually older at all. It's just right. It's just like her innate maturity.
Exactly.
Yeah, being classic Sal and Godric. Yeah, you know, yeah. Totally using it.
Oh my gosh, yeah. such fun, such jokesters.
Such jokesters. No, so I love that. Going back to again the Sorting Hat's original song though, there's a couple of lines that are pretty just, you know, great in here. But
yes.
The one that stood out to me this time around was it says, "Oh, you may not think I'm pretty, but don't judge on what you see. I'll eat myself if you can find a smarter hat than me." The "I'll eat myself" is a really funny reference to just like a sort of slang throwaway term. It's like "I'll eat my hat."
Oh,
you
yes.
know, and it's like he like the Sorting Hat is basically saying like, "I'll eat myself because I can't eat my hat because I am a hat."
Oh, I also like when he says, "For I'm the Hogwarts Sorting Hat and I can cap them all." And it's like, he's making a hat pun. Yeah. He the hat is making a hat pun about capping people. That's hilarious. What I appreciate about the opening song is that despite all of the negativity you've heard about Slytherin going in, the hat itself does not give Slytherin like a negative
spin.
Yep. He just says, "You'll make your real friends. Those cunny folks use any means to achieve their ends." And it's like, you could interpret that, but it's like, for all intents and purposes, that's just like, you know, oh yeah, these people get stuff done. But I don't know if you ever do this. Whenever I read this particular phrasing, it's like, I always feel like the word bitter has been left out. Like, "These cunning folks use any means to achieve their bitter ends." Like, I don't know why my brain always fills that in. Do you ever fill that in?
I have never filled that in my head before, but I can absolutely see like where you're coming from.
Right. Is that a phrase like to achieve, is like bitter, is that part of like a phrase?
The phrase like "to the bitter end," you know, is sort of like and you know, and they held out till the bitter end.
It feels to me like the way it's worded is meant to leave the word "bitter" hanging in the air. Like, oh, you thought we were going to say that, but I made it a little more fair.
Sure.
And it's like, no, but actually it is more negative because it's Slytherin.
So do you think that the Sorting Hat is sort of like letting the audience itself sort of like interpret what it's left out? It's like, I'm not going to be like actively anti-Slytherin in my spiel here. I do think it's interesting that Slytherin comes last both in the song and also when Professor McGonagall is listing off the various houses. Four houses are called Gryffindor, Hufflepuff, Ravenclaw, and Slytherin. So, like, she does even lead with her own house, which is Gryffindor.
She does. That's actually the same order the hat goes in.
Okay. As well. So, yeah. So maybe that's. It's also alphabetical, is it?
It
not?
Is.
Yeah.
So maybe that's part of it.
Yeah.
Who knows? Okay. Interpret it what you will. There. Yeah. Anyway, I don't have too much more to say about the song itself, but then we do get into the sorting, where you get introduced to just a myriad of students, some of whom go on to show up as like Harry's friends or classmates later on, some of whom, like Brocklehurst Mandy, never hear from them again.
Yeah, I know. You know? It's yeah, so you've got like Millicent Bulstrode who comes up just all the time and always, Lavender Brown, but yeah, you're right. There's another character who I think I was reading, I'm trying to find what their name is now, because of course it is like actively forgettable. I think it's Sally Ann Perks, maybe, is like one of the names that's listed. And I think later in book five, when they're like reading off names to like step forth for your like OWL's examinations, you get like a lot of throwbacks to these early names. But like, this is one of the ones that's just like left off.
Which one?
I think it's Sally Ann Perks.
Sally Ann Perks. Did I miss that reading through just now?
Let's see here. Yeah, it's after Patil, and then Perks, Sally Ann.
Oh, Sally Ann Perks. Wow, you're right. There it is again. What a forgettable name. There's
a bunch of other interesting things that I feel like happened during the sorting. Seamus Finnegan, for example, is like someone who is like one of the only ones that gets like a Neville does too, but Seamus specifically has like a little bit of like a pause.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about that is Seamus is the one sort of directly before Hermione, who quite literally we know through like Pottermore reading is a hat stall.
Yeah.
So it's like, it literally says like Finnegan Seamus, the sandy haired boy next to Harry in line, sat on the stool for almost a whole minute before the hat declared him a Gryffindor. And then Granger Hermione. And it's just like, you know, the hat went on her head, Gryffindor.
I know. Like, it's like this is definitely like a retcon thing where it's like, oh, Hermione, definitely that one was more important.
but like, where else would you have even put like Seamus? Like, it doesn't seem like he, in the same way as like some of the others, have like an obvious, like you could say like Ron and Hufflepuff, Hermione and Ravenclaw, like, you know, Neville and Hufflepuff or whatever. Like, but this is not one where Seamus is always like embodied.
I know. I underlined almost a whole minute and wrote down, like, I wonder what the debate was between.
I know. Yeah.
Like, the only thing that really stands out to me is that later on in book five, when the ministry is like attacking Harry, Seamus is like the Gryffindor boy who's kind of against Harry that year, like clinging more to like his mom's beliefs that the ministry is correct. And I don't know where that would place Seamus otherwise then, though. Like, what that attitude might represent. Like, possibly, like, he's just, like, more loyal to his family. So maybe, like, Hufflepuff or something. Or maybe just, like, all the Slytherins are against Harry. So maybe Slytherin. It doesn't seem like I don't have any arguments for Ravenclaw.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like he's ever been, like, described as like, being, like a super student or something like that. He almost seems more like a little bit of, like a class clown jokester type.
Yeah. I mean, like, the attitude he displays when he isn't aligning with Harry is, like, maybe more similar to, like, Zachariah Smith.
Yeah,
who is in Hufflepuff?
Right, that's a good point. That's a good point.
I guess it could be that one.
But this just goes to show as well that like your sorting doesn't always like perfectly indicate, you know, necessarily what your characteristics will be like. So
yeah,
there is that. But yeah, so then Hermione of course does get sorted, and it does feel like there's just like a bit of like a quick oversight that she would be like a candidate for Ravenclaw in there, like with, you know, just like being extremely studious and valuing like intelligence and wanting to excel.
Yeah,
particularly like with grades and stuff like that. Then we do get Neville, who it does give us like just the phrase, the hat took a long time to decide with Neville when it finally shouted Gryffindor. You know, so that's sort of like, you know, we do know why.
Yeah,
that.
And then he gives the hat to Morag McDougal, who never comes up again as far as I'm concerned.
I specifically looked up Morag because I was like, is this the name of Aragog's? I almost did the thing. Aragog's wife.
Mosag. Yeah.
But interestingly, Morag is the name of the second most famous, like, Loch monster.
Like, besides the Loch Ness monster?
Besides Nessie.
Okay.
Morag is the next most highly regarded, like, Loch monster.
Oh, okay. Like, lake monster.
Lake monster, yeah.
Okay.
And so the decision for the use of the name Morag is possibly could be a reference to
that's interesting. That, like, well, the other thing that stood out here, and I can never remember this, is the surname McDougal, because I know whenever there, like, when you learn McGonagall's backstory, if you do some like extra reading on Pottermore, I can never remember whether she was like engaged to Gregor McDougal or Dougal McGregor.
Dougal McGregor.
It's Dougal McGregor. Okay, yeah. Never mind. Not important. Not related. I read that. I was like, wait, Gregor McDougal? Was that related? Is this who that did McGonagall's ex-flame marry someone else and produce Morag?
Yeah, right. Yeah. I know. Oh my gosh. Can you imagine? Like, and then it has to be McGonagall who like called them forward.
Like, yeah, like McDougal. She's having like a little private battle over there.
I know. Yeah. And then this better not be in Gryffindor.
I know. But let's see. But we don't even know where Morag goes.
Yeah, we don't know at all.
Except, I guess, not Gryffindor.
Not Gryffindor. Yeah.
Yeah.
We know that much.
Then Moon comes after him, and there's just like a little bit of trivia around Moon, who was also never mentioned again. But, The character here in Harry's Year with the last name Moon, that was originally going to be the character of Luna Lovegood.
Yes, yeah, where Luna, of course, is the Spanish word for moon.
Yeah.
You know, and that is always like one of the interesting ones when like Luna goes on to be such a prominent part of the group as the story unfolds, because like everyone else in their lineup, like you meet Ginny, Neville, Harry, Ron, Hermione, all right away. They're all there the whole time. And then Luna doesn't make her appearance until book five.
I know.
It's like remarkable that.
Which is like, I mean, I would have loved to have been known what Luna was thinking during like Chamber of Secrets, you know?
Oh, I know. Yeah.
Like, what's she doing? Because she's there.
Certainly Luna has something to say.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And chances are, but you know, we just made a video a couple weeks ago, like Luna's always right. Like chances are Luna would have totally like been able to be like, oh, it's obvious, it's a basilisk, isn't it? Yeah. 100%. Basilisks aren't real, Luna.
It'd be so funny because if she brought that up, it'd be like, that's a pretty good guess, actually. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense now that you say it. Yeah,
now you say it. Yeah, that's pretty spot on. Yep.
Yep.
And Luna does seem to have like a bit of a knowledge base about Fantastic Beasts, so it seems entirely possible that she actually would have cracked open the otherwise non-essential reading Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them as a first year.
I know, as a first year, there she is right there.
Yep.
Because is that one of those that's like not in there?
What's not in there?
The basilisk.
Oh, maybe it's. Oh man, I can't remember now. My brain literally was like having a ping pong battle on whether or not I thought it was. I thought it was.
God, I am so curious. Now I want to know because this is like a weird thing. If you can buy the apparent textbook Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, which is published for us muggles, apparently. But you're like buying like Newt Scamander's version of it.
Yes.
Yeah, and like. But what's weird about it is that there are so many animals that, like, even in the movies for the Fantastic Beasts movies, you see Newt interact with that are not in the book.
Notably, the Zowu is, like, one of the really big ones. And then the Manticore, I think, is, like, a very misrepresented creature.
It's under there. Then there's the Swooping Evil, which is, like, Newt's, like, little ace monster up his sleeve, like, the entire first movie. That's not in there.
Or the Chillin.
Or the Chillin.
Yeah, which is spelled
Q-I-L-I-N.
Yeah.
The Chillin, that's like the little horse dragon thing that can tell whether or not you're pure of heart. And it's like, you can see maybe why Newt wouldn't put that in there. Like, within the context of the movie Secrets of Dumbledore, the Chillin is this, like, super rare animal that, like, is nearly in danger. There's, like, maybe three in the world or something.
Would you describe it as a horse dragon?
That is what it... I would describe it as a deer. But when I was recently reading about it for a video, the Wikipedia page listed it as like a half dragon, half horse.
Oh,
and
okay.
I was gonna say
I would go with deer like 11 times out of 10.
So would I. But apparently that's what it's supposed to look like, is half dragon, half horse.
Okay.
So anyway, I can see why Newt, who cares about Fantastic Beasts and their preservation, would not actually list where to find it or tell you anything about the Chillin at all. So now I'm wondering though, like if basilisks are in Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, then there's almost no reason the entire school isn't immediately onto the fact that it's a basilisk, because like even first year should have learned about them.
Right. So then it would almost be interesting if it's not in there, because it's like, that's how they didn't figure it out.
That's why they didn't figure it out. This is really your fault, Newt.
Newt.
Come on, man.
Although they literally have the chocolate frog card with Dumbledore on it that has Nicholas Flamel, and nobody can think of why the name like rings a bell in the back of their mind.
Well, that's true too. But like, it doesn't just have to be first year. It's surprising to me that Dumbledore can't figure out it's a basilisk, you know?
This
especially because it has happened, he's had 50 years to think about it.
Yes.
You know? Why doesn't Dumbledore ask Myrtle anything?
Yeah.
How has no one asked Myrtle how she died? It is so also on that exact note, in this exact chapter, the same thing happens where they're talking to Nearly Headless Nick, and Seamus asks Nearly Headless Nick, how did he get covered in blood, about the Bloody Baron? And Nearly Headless Nick says, I've never asked. Are you kidding me, Nick? Are you kidding me? You haven't asked the Bloody Baron how he died in the last 1,000 years? Because that's ridiculous if you ask me. And honestly, if you had asked him, then you could have answered this question right here, and we might have solved the entire diadem mystery on like day one. So I'm blaming Nearly Headless Nick on this one.
Well, there you go. But you said 1,000 years, and it set me up perfectly, because specifically in the book, it is written as like, we know that we go to Nearly Headless Nick's 500th birthday party.
You're right. The Bloody Baron, though, was alive at the same time as Salazar Slytherin.
You're correct. So the Bloody Baron,
he's been dead for about 500 years longer.
Yeah, so the Bloody Baron's been there twice as long as Nearly Headless Nick. However, in the audiobook, again, this is like one of those another small edit, but the audiobook does say it's been he hasn't eaten anything for nearly 400 years. But it is edited after the fact for nearly 500 years, because we know that he was killed in the year 1492, and then 500 years later would be 1992, which is when the Chamber of Secrets is opened, and also when he has his 500th birthday party.
On Halloween.
On Halloween. I always feel like the fact that it's specifically like 1492, I'm like, is there some type of strange, like Christopher Columbus exploration related detail? It's like 1492 was just such an obscure date for it to also have like otherwise noteworthiness, which right. is, you know, the year that.
Yeah, that nearly Nick was killed.
Yeah, and Columbus yeah. sailed.
So and Columbus sailed, yeah.
Like, what are the odds of that? So anyway, that's just a total brief aside. But I always think it's interesting whenever, because I will read and listen to the book or the chapters before we do our episodes. And like when there are those like little like isms.
Yeah,
it's like,
corrections.
Oh,
yeah.
Because obviously Jim Dale recorded this, you know, like.
Oh, yeah, like forever ago.
Yeah, So, I mean, he recorded it with whatever the original phrasing was.
Yeah.
So, just another small modification that I caught there.
Through the Gryffindor is supported by Pair Eyewear. Y'all, I am so excited for our upcoming Through the Griffin tour. It is going to be such a good time. But as ever, when you're going to be spending time in front of people, you want to be looking your darned best. And let me tell you what, Pair Eyewear has arrived just in the nick of time. Like, honestly, I was immediately blown away with my new frame. So let me walk you through exactly what they do. So starting at just $60, including your prescription, you can get your base frames, which are like sleek, modern, and stylish. But that is really just the start, because from there, you get to fully customize each frame, all of your looks, by simply snapping on the top frames. And they actually have an entire collection of Harry Potter frames. So like for the upcoming tour, I was so pumped. I was like, oh my gosh, I've got to find some super cool Slytherin frames that I can like wear. But then as I was clicking around, I've been watching X-Men 97, which is like so good, and they actually had X-Men frames as well. And then May the 4th is coming up, or maybe by the time you're listening it's already passed, but like they have a huge collection of over 20 Star Wars frames as well. So I had a very hard time narrowing, and I ended up getting two. I got the X-Men ones and I got some Slytherin ones. So many different like fandom frames you can choose from. And I never thought to accessorize my glasses with fandom stuff, but now you can. And it's so easy to change between them. Like they have little magnets on them, so you can just slap a different frame onto the front of your glasses and then easily switch it out. I've been doing it all day. It's so fun. And before you commit to anything, you can explore all the different possibilities with their virtual try-on. But again, the base frames for men, women, or kids. I think honestly kids would love this because you can just switch them out and they're so fun looking. They all start at $60. One pair, infinite possibilities. Go to PairEyewear.com and use code GRIFFIN for 15% off your first pair, and support the show by mentioning that Through the Gryffindor sent you in your post-checkout survey. That's PairEyewear.com, code GRIFFIN.
Let's see here.
Let's see. Harry sees Professor Quirrell up at the table as he's looking down there, and I guess it describes him as he was looking very peculiar in a large purple turban. This is like, I made a note, like, was he not wearing the turban when they met the first time? I guess not.
We made this point, I think, actually, because at the time that he would have met Harry at the Leaky Cauldron, Harry shakes his hand, and it's like he's wearing the turban to conceal.
Yeah, I mean, he's wearing the turban now to conceal Voldemort.
Right, but Harry shakes his hand, which means that Voldemort wasn't occupying his body at the time of the Leaky Cauldron.
Right.
So this was a change. So I actually appreciate this line because it does explain that that something has happened of note in this like interim. I always thought that this line was such a, like, the misdirect between Quirrell and Snape throughout this whole book is so like well played. Even in the movies, that you have the scene like where Harry like makes, you know, like eye contact with Snape, and like Quirrell is quite literally like facing the other way behind him. It's like man, like, you know, you have to get that detail right because it is so important, but it's so easy to not realize what's actually happening.
Oh, it's very good. And then the same thing happens at the Quidditch match when like Hermione lights Snape's robes on fire. Like you can go see Quirrell get knocked down.
Yes.
And, like, that's actually what does it, which is stinky. The thing about this particular scene, it's like it is cleverly done where it's like Quirrell's looking the other way, which so it's actually Voldemort causing his scar to hurt, not Snape. But like what that sort of means is that like for the rest of the year, Quirrell never had his back turned to Harry. Like in class or anything, you know?
Well, he is facing the class with a rather large iguana.
We've all seen that one, of course.
It is one of those things where it is so hilarious to me that in the films when they show Quirrell teaching that he's holding this just comically large iguana, because it's just such a, like, obviously non-magical creature.
Why?
Sure, why not?
Okay. May as well have him holding that iguana.
We got to scoot forward because we just did a really fun. We shot a really funny Jay versus Ben about treats in the Wizarding World, and we had a conversation about this particular treat, which is the peppermint humbugs.
Yeah.
And notably, it is one of, like, the items when all the food appears in the Great Hall, which has always been, like, when I was a kid, I was like, oh my gosh, this would be, like, so cool and interesting and fascinating. Actually, even on that note, let me pause for, like, one more second. I have seen a theory before that Nitwit, Blubber, Oddment, and Tweak are names of house elves who prepared the feast.
Oh, that's an interesting one.
So what Dumbledore is actually doing here is recognizing the house elves who had contributed to that year's feast.
I like that theory too.
Because it's literally like, it's what he says, and then he says thank you, and then the feast appears. So it's literally like one of those things where it's like, oh, that's kind of like a fun other explanation otherwise. But this is so funny because I think what we were talking about, where were we?
I think it's in Hagrid's coat. It is described that there are peppermint humbugs
yes.
in his coat, and like Harry identifies them as peppermint humbugs, and we were unsure, like, is that like a British thing? Because if it's a magic thing, Harry shouldn't know what they are yet.
Yes, and it is. I have looked it up. It is a hard boiled sweet that is like notable in like a bunch of different countries, but specifically Great Britain.
Okay,
is one where
so for some reason peppermint humbugs is like a, and for some reason. This random candy,
yes,
this muggle candy.
Yes. Which also, comes out with like the main course. Like, so to think of a candy as being something, because then dessert pops up.
Oh yeah. Not with the peppermint humbug. So yes. This is one with like peppermint humbugs. It sounds like, oh, whatever you must like. When I read that, I'm like, humbug must be like a word for some sort of a different word for like a certain kind of insect in Europe.
Oh, and, sure. Yes.
And yeah. Now they're like peppermint humbugs.
Right.
How magical. Like, yeah, like chocolate frog.
It sounds very like whimsical. But I do know, I mean, like, it's not uncommon, you know, like in the same way that people carry gum or mints or something in their pocket. Like, I feel like that's probably just like why Hagrid had them. They were effectively just like mints. So again, just like one of those things where, like, you know, as an American where it didn't immediately mean something, you just sort of assumed that it was magical, and it's not. So I thought that was fascinating. Yeah. And also fascinating that Harry specifically does not, like, he grabs one of everything except for the peppermints.
And he's like, never mind that. Peppermints? I don't think so. You know what he does grab, Ben? Potatoes.
Potatoes.
I don't know what there is this once you notice it, you can't unnotice it. There's just this like running theme that the Gryffindors love potatoes. So like there's right here, Percy's having some potatoes, offers them to Harry, and then amongst, maybe it's just like magical people like potatoes, which just doesn't seem like a very magical food, but there's all these things showing up on the table, and there are boiled potatoes, roast potatoes, and fries. So the house elves, maybe Nitwit, Blubber, Oddment, and Tweak, have made three different kinds of potato offerings for the students.
It's like, how many different...
Why? Yeah,
how many starches do we need in this dish tonight?
I know.
Is three enough? Should we go for four?
I'm going to fill them up.
We could throw some baked potatoes in if we want
to. We could do it. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Just a snap of the fingers. Yeah. So then we get, like, you know, of course, yeah, the introduction to the ghosts. Yep. You know, throughout this chapter, we do get like a little bit of backstory on three of the four ghosts, but not the Grey Lady.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting. Because,
well, what's interesting is it describes that there being like 20 different ghosts or whatever.
That's true.
Yeah. But then it's like Nearly Headless Nick definitely describes the Bloody Baron as the Slytherin ghost. And
right.
Nick is definitely the Gryffindor. Like, there is like a house ghost per house. And yet that leaves like 16 other ghosts that are also there that must have gone to Hogwarts, because why else would they be haunting Hogwarts? And if they went to Hogwarts, they were sorted into houses. So why aren't they considered house ghosts?
It's not entirely clear. Maybe not, it's just like clear. I think we eventually learned that the Forbidden Forest is like a home to a bunch of magical creatures, so it's like a safe place for them to live. So maybe it's the same with ghosts, where it's just sort of like you can flock to Hogwarts and like you're welcome here.
But they still would have gone there.
Yes, they probably would have.
I guess, but like Myrtle is like in the bathroom and she was in Ravenclaw, but she's not, I mean, she's not the Ravenclaw ghost, but she's a ghost who was in Ravenclaw.
She's the ghost of that bathroom.
She's the ghost of that bathroom, that's for sure, with a mysterious death that no one asks her about, even though there is such an obvious way to figure out who killed her.
Yeah.
My goodness, what a serious... serious oversight.
It is. It is indeed. The other, maybe not an oversight, but the way that Neville sort of like sidesteps, like everybody's kind of talking about like what their heritage is like. So Seamus is sort of saying like, you know, my dad's a muggle, mom's a witch, you know, a bit of a nasty shock for him. You know, and then Neville like is just sort of like, well, my grand brought me up. And then like, you know, talks about like my great uncle Algy and like some other like family members and stuff. Great auntie Enid. But I always think the fact that like the great uncle Algy here, like algae is sort of like a thing that grows, yeah. And Neville obviously goes on to have some pretty significant like abilities in the field of herbology, and will eventually teach herbology at the school. So I feel like it's sort of like an interesting like little nod to like something that he will eventually have like talent in,
right?
And I, you know, for the longest time, this is like one of those things I always thought the great uncle algae and the story of like Neville bouncing, like in my head, this was like additional reading. This was like if you want to read more about Neville, like, you know, he didn't show his magical abilities early, so like, you know, like whatever, like, you know, we can go into the whole history of that. But no, it's just like right here in the canon. It's a rather large chapter about Neville's backstory, none of which includes anything to do with his parents.
Yep. Actually, this is a thing I'm surprised that hasn't been like retconned to the tune of the four legs or whatever. But when Neville's talking about it, or when they're talking about family, he says, well, my gran brought me up and she's a witch, said Neville. But the family thought I was all muggle for ages. And it's like, all muggle is really not the right word for that situation. It's like the word is squib. Right?
You're right.
You know, there's really no reason that Neville, the pure blood from the pure blood family, wouldn't say the word, wouldn't know the word
squib.
And this feels like the Dementor problem. That's what I wrote down, was the Dementor problem, where it's like the term squib, it like doesn't want to be introduced until Filch next year.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, when you're actually going to learn it. And so until then, we'll just say non-magical or all muggle. But yeah, that definitely should be the word squib, but it's like they describe the Dementors as the Azkaban guards right up until Harry meets one, and then they're just called Dementors from there on out, because it's like just meant to be a reveal for the audience, I guess.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. But you did tee me up nicely there with your reference to good old Argus.
Yeah.
Mr. Filch. So
Mr. Filch.
He is not yet referred to as a squib, and I feel like for good reason, because I don't think he's a squib at all. I think he's a poltergeist.
Yeah.
This has forever been one of like, what, in my personal opinion, I feel like it's like one of the like just most concrete theories that we've come up with.
It just makes sense.
It does make sense. So basically, like the idea,
because Filch does not make sense.
Filch doesn't. It's like, why would you have somebody who is so like non-magical existing inside of this castle full of magical calamities, and his job is to solve magical calamities, when clearly all of the other professors can quite literally like the swamp that Fred and George create, like Flitwick, I think, cleans it up with like the flick of his wand.
Yeah.
You know, and like intentionally leaves a portion of it as like a, you know, a tribute to the twins' departure and stuff like that. Like it's a situation where it doesn't even seem like, as time goes on, like Dumbledore necessarily like super like respects Filch's ultimate authority inside of the castle. Like, you know, I think he's like, it's maybe like two books from now or something like that, but Dumbledore will eventually make a reference that's like, you know, you're not to use products from wherever, as I've been reminded by Filch like 392 times or something like that. And it's like, it's just so interesting because, you know, Dumbledore is always gracious to everybody. So like, you know, it seems like he would always respect everything. But, you know, it's just, I don't know, like everything about Filch doesn't make sense. But then his opposition is always Peeves. And Peeves is a poltergeist that we learn in this chapter basically is like a manifestation of the rule breaking inside of the school. And so like, if these two are to be mirrors of one another, then like Filch is almost supposed to be like an aggressive adherence to the rules.
Right. So if like if Peeves, yeah, so the way poltergeists are made in the wizarding world is that if there's too much of one behavior, so like in the example of Hogwarts Castle, there's like so much rule breaking all the time by the students that it has manifested the poltergeist Peeves, which is why he's different from ghosts.
Yes.
And so he is the literal like embodiment of breaking the rules, which is why no one can control him any of the time.
Right.
So conversely, our theory is that Filch is the opposite. He is the manifestation of all the students that are like aggressively following the rules, like the Percys, or maybe just like the teachers
or whatever. Absolutely.
Yep. And so like there is this sort of like running theme that like we've talked about it on the podcast before, that like magic is sort of has like a, what, how we've been describing it, has like a,
quirkiness
to it. Like magic is inherently breaking the rules because like muggles can't use magic. Like the ability to use magic is breaking the rules.
Right.
And so like by following the rules strictly, that is a very non-magical thing to do. Like Dumbledore, like sort of quietly, like even what you just said, where he says like Filch has reminded me 392 times not to, you know, use these products or whatever. It's like he's telling them that, but at the same time he's basically like, please go ahead and use them.
Right.
Like,
you know, exactly,
like he's like lightly
like
encouraging some rule breaking. Like,
yes.
Like, you know, they exist, but he doesn't really mind if students break the rules a little bit. So if Filch then is the poltergeist generated by all of the strict adherence to rules, then he is non-magical at all.
Right. Yes, right. Yeah, exactly. So, and maybe therefore, like, you get that squib, like, title attached to him.
Because he looks so much more like a regular human being, whereas Peeves is, like, floating around doing all kinds of magical wackadoo things.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. Yeah,
he's
absolutely.
He's, like, more of a traditional poltergeist, whereas the kind of poltergeist that Filch is just, like, so boring. But it's, like, otherwise, he's just, like, why would he want this job where he has to do manual labor for no reason? It's like Harry comes in at one point, like from Quidditch, muddy somehow, and he like gets mud all over it, and Filch yells at him, and he's like, it's an extra few hours of mopping for me. And it's like, but like, it's such a mean job because, yeah, magically you could just get rid of the mud immediately.
There's
no reason this job should be held by someone who has to do manual labor.
No, it literally makes no sense. Like, it's either Filch's inclusion at the school is mean, or it's like literally a byproduct of the school.
Yeah, like they cannot get rid of him.
Yes. Yeah.
Which seems more likely to me. Because the other thing is, like, Filch is like, he does not seem to like kids at all. Like, anytime anyone in Dumbledore's presence brings up the idea of like harming the students, it is like the one thing that sets him off.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Hardcore.
Yeah.
And yet, Filch is constantly like advocating for like whipping and thumbscrews and dungeons. And it's like, yeah, you can work here. It's fine.
It's fine. It's like, you can't, I know that you can't do any of it.
Yeah.
Right. You will never succeed in the same way that, you know, they also can't really banish Peeves either.
Right.
And that's like, you know, if you go into the deeper archives of it, like, you'll know that there have been like attempts to do so, and it's like you just can't. Like, it's like a calamity of the school that has to be there because this is sort of like, again, the quirkiness of magic.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So anyway, love that. That's always been one of my favorite favorite theories, and
yes.
I feel like it holds true, and it doesn't harm the narrative at all. You know, it's not like it changes literally anything other than like just maybe makes you a bit more comfortable with why and how Filch is in such an unfair position.
Oh, I know. I know we harp on this one so much. Filch, it's like there's so much to say for a character who is not really around much, but it's like anytime Harry is out in the castle at night, there's always the threat of running into Filch, which is, you know, it sounds like, oh, well, yeah, of course, you know, you gotta have like some threat looming out in the castle, but like Filch is working all day, so why isn't he sleeping at night?
Yeah.
You know, it's like he's not, because he doesn't need to sleep because he's not a real person.
There you go.
Anyway, moving on. I love that Dumbledore says that first year should note the forbidden force on the grounds is forbidden to all pupils, like, and, you know, unless you have detention, in which case we'll send you right in there. Which I think is funny. And then I also like how Hogwarts is always described as like the safest place except for, you know, Gringotts, except maybe Hogwarts or whatever. So safe. And yet even the opening speech, Dumbledore is like, oh yeah, the third floor corridor on the right hand side, out of bounds to everyone who does not wish to die. It's like, to die? Wait, by death, do you mean like, you mean died? It's like, yeah. Welcome to the safest school in the world.
Yeah. It's like,
you could die.
Right. It's like, as long as you follow the rules, you're completely fine.
Like, did you like magically lock it with some sort of like powerful Dumbledore level spell? And it's like, I put a padlock on it. you can undo it with magic you've learned before you got here. Alohomora, you know. Don't worry about it.
Oh my gosh, you set me up so nicely.
Yeah.
Can I give you a bit of information and knowledge here? Because you're exactly right. Alohomora is a term that is specifically taken from. And I hope I don't butcher this explanation, but it's a like field of like fortune telling called geomancy.
Oh.
And it comes from like Madagascar, and there's a whole batch of terms that fall underneath of this. Alohomora is one of them, which I think is supposed to like roughly translate to like thieves' friend. Or friendly to thieves, I think is what it's supposed to be. But interestingly, other terms inside of geomancy include Caput Draconis, which is going to be the password to get into the Gryffindor common room. It's the first one we ever learned.
That's interesting.
Other terms include Albus, Rubeus, and Fortuna Major, which is also a future Gryffindor
password.
Yeah. So a whole bunch of words have been borrowed from geomancy, which again is this like Madagascar version of fortune telling.
Well, that's interesting because I looked up what Caput Draconis was, and it's actually just Latin for dragon's head.
It is dragon's head. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. And even in geomancy, that is also what it means.
Okay.
So you're like nail on the head there. But which I also, that was the reason that I started going down that hole in the first place, because I was like, dragon's head, like, you know, like what is this? Why would this be the first password? Like, it feels like it's asking to have significance. And I mean, we know that like the Caput Draconis, I think, is the head of the Draco star constellation.
That'd be interesting since Draco is a character.
Yeah. But head of the dragon, is there some possibility that this is supposed to be like a little like friendly nudge to the Gryffindors? Like, hey, we got to take down those Slytherins. They keep winning the house cup. Like,
right.
You know, like, is it like a, like, you know, be aware of the head of the dragon.
But like, they don't know Draco's going to be the Slytherin.
No, they don't. Yeah. So it's really just kind of like random and odd. Like,
the school motto, like, never tickle a sleeping dragon.
Yes.
Right. So then the password is head of the dragon.
Yep.
Right. So is the castle itself like a metaphor for a dragon? In which case, then the Gryffindors are basically like, yeah, we're the head of the dragon.
They are in a tower.
And then if you were to say, like, never tickle a sleeping dragon, that could be, like, a reference to, like, Voldemort attacking the school in Book 7. Like, look what happens.
If you damn, okay.
You know, yeah, priori incantatum. That's the wrong word. What is it? Locomotor. Totem locomotor, yeah.
Oh, you mean the defensive spell?
I've always wanted to use that spell.
One of the greatest Maggie Smith, Minerva McGonagall moments in all of the films. Which is saying something because she has so many.
Yeah, really.
But anyway, yeah. So no, I thought that was very, you brought up the Alohomora and I was like, oh my gosh, I have so many fun facts about exactly where this came from.
I'm loving the idea of Hogwarts as a dragon.
Yeah.
Never tickle a sleeping dragon.
Yeah.
Never tickle. Oh, man. Then it's like, oh, boy. Now I'm going like, my head is immediately spinning. I'm like, what if the castle is like a transfigured dragon? You know?
Whoa.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Here we go. All right. Yeah. All right. I'm going to think about it more. Let me know what you guys think in review form. 5 stars.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Can you? Okay. So here now my mind is like spinning on like a season finale of our founder series where the four founders have found themselves in like the mountains of Scotland and there is a gigantic dragon.
Gigantic.
Like huge, massive.
Massive.
And it's like the adversary, but like maybe not like, maybe it's not like an evil kind of adversary. It's more like dangerous because of like some other reason, but it's like, it's not really like the dragon's fault of sorts,
right,
you know?
Right.
But like, so the end result is sort of like they have this like, ha ha, hilarious calamity, like, don't tickle a sleeping dragon. Like, we all know better now, don't we? But like, at least now we're living inside of the halls that was formerly that giant dragon.
That was formerly a dragon. But yeah. You know, this reminds me, like, because we have the theory that the night bus is like a transfigured Zowu.
Yes, we do.
Yeah, which is like, so that would lend some credence to like animals could become, I mean, it's just transfiguration. Animals could become like a larger physical structure.
Well,
we
even know that like in transfiguration class, it's pretty common for them to transfigure like objects into animals.
The more I'm thinking about it, the more I'm loving this idea, just straight up, that the castle was a dragon.
And that the Gryffindor common room is the head of the dragon.
Oh, there's so many. Okay, there's other things you'd have to explain, but I feel like I already work. Okay, listen. All right, let's see. I believe the reason the castle is located where it is because Rowena Ravenclaw was a seer.
Yep.
Right? Okay. And she had a dream one night about a boar digging in the ground on top of a cliff.
Okay.
And then which is why it's called Hogwarts, because it's a hog that's digging in the ground. And like, that's the location where the castle is built.
Okay.
So, they go there, and then apparently when they dig where the hog was digging, that's when they find the pensieve, which is, I don't know how that fits in with the dragon idea. Now I'm like, is the pensieve the brain of the dragon or something?
That would be really cool. It'd make it a very singular object.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But like, pensieves are not necessarily singular things unless this has happened more times than once.
Right. So what is the description that's given when Muggles see Hogwarts? Because it's supposed to, is it like smoldering?
It's supposed to look like ruins, yeah.
Does it say smoldering or am I adding smoldering?
I don't know.
Because it feels like dragons.
That's a Goblet of Fire trivia question. That's when they're talking about how no one knows where Hogwarts is.
Yeah. But like that's like one of those where it's like...
Smoldering. Smoldering's a little more dragony.
I know. Yeah. Hold on.
Okay. I'm gonna look up smoldering on my ebook version of Goblet of Fire, because now I'm really curious. Are we onto something? Are we having a theory mid-podcast?
Oh my gosh. I can't even tell you guys. This is so frequently how it happens. And
I know.
One of the chief objectives, I feel like, we had in doing this particular podcast doing through the Gryffindor was like, we're going to be combing through this book in a way that we've never done it before. Like, we've both read it a lot, but we've never gone through and like really examined like every single detail in the same way that we are this time. So it's fun to even like feel it like happening in real time.
Smoldering is used, but it is not to describe what the castle looks like to Muggles.
I know. Double darn.
Buts. Okay. I'm just going to look up ruins and see what the word actually is. Not that it necessarily matters. The modern is, ruins isn't even used to describe the castle itself at all. So don't worry about that. We'll worry about this later. Possible theory, Hogwarts was a dragon.
Yeah. I like it. So anyway, yeah. And hopefully that was an enjoyable experience watching us like brainstorm in real time. Hopefully if when we make a video about it, it'll be more highly refined than that. That being said, we can close off pretty nicely with the chapter, because we do get one of Harry's infamous dreams.
Yes.
Harry's dreams are always really, really, really important to the overall story. A lot of times they're telling him things that he like will come to know, needs to know. Like, he learns a lot from his dreams. In this particular case, it's actually not that situation.
It's really just for our benefit.
Yeah, it's a rare occasion where the like omniscient narrator is able to give us a piece of information that Harry himself doesn't know. That could be a bit of a tip of the hat, no pun intended, towards what is actually going to happen as this story unfolds.
Right.
And again, it's actually quite telling, because basically. It says, perhaps Harry had eaten a bit too much because he had a very strange dream. He was wearing Professor Quirrell's turban, which kept talking to him. That's sort of like a little bit of a like sorting hat reference.
Yeah, a little bit. But then it's also just like Voldemort's head underneath the turban.
Right. But like, I feel like at this point in time, it's sort of like you're just supposed to have like a swirl of all of the night's events kind of like racing through Harry's mind. So it's like, the turban. Why not? Like, that could be one of the things that's going on in there. But in reality, like... this is almost his dream telling him like, hey, you know, there is something inside of Coral's turban that could talk to you.
Right.
But basically that thing is telling him that he must transfer to Slytherin at once because it was his destiny. This feels like, you know, we talked a little bit about like the Sorting Hat as it's reviewing Harry's own mind. And I can't believe we actually haven't even really super talked about this that much. But it pretty much provides an accolade to each of the various houses for Harry. So what the Sorting Hat says when Harry puts it on is difficult, very difficult, plenty of courage, I see. Not a bad mind either. So those are, of course, Gryffindor
and Ravenclaw.
Yep, respectively. There's talent, oh my goodness, yes, which could... It's I can't necessarily specifically pin it to Hufflepuff because it seems like all the houses have talent, but because the next one is and a nice thirst to prove yourself. Now that's interesting. That feels like the Slytherin.
Yeah, it feels like the Slytherin one. So by like process of elimination, the talent one must be Hufflepuff.
Is what it feels like. Yeah.
Kind of feels like when you think about like Cedric, that sort of makes sense too.
It definitely does. Yeah. Yeah, like he's like just like a highly talented wizard. And if Cedric is to embody what it means to be a Hufflepuff in like its most like obvious way, then yeah. I think it's an easy sell for me.
Yeah.
That's what that's in regards to. But the big question here is like, is part of the reason that the house is considering Slytherin, or if the Hat is considering Slytherin for Harry, because of the piece of Voldemort's soul that we know is inside of Harry.
Right.
Like, is it misleading the hat? You know, because the hat's like, I'm never wrong. And it's like, yeah, but how often are you examining a soul that literally has two souls?
Right. Yeah.
And so what's kind of interesting about it is that, like, you know, the fact that the turban is insisting that Harry transfer to Slytherin because it was his destiny. Like, to me, that feels like that's what it's saying. Like that it is the piece of Voldemort's soul.
Oh, that's like telling him to go to Slytherin?
Yeah.
Or that's informing the hat?
Yeah.
Well, the other part that you could, I guess you could say, is that because we know that under the turban is Voldemort.
Yes.
Right. So if that's the case, then if the turban is talking to him in his dream, is it possible that like Voldemort is already aware of Harry and like, is he the one behind the dream?
Ooh.
You know? Like, he's just like, oh, I know who I'm going to mess with tonight.
Well, I think that's very likely because yeah. we know that, like, for the first time that Harry... The first time we ever witness having, like a physiological reaction to the proximity to Voldemort is when Quirrell's turban is facing him.
Yeah.
And in that instance, it basically feels like what happened is Voldemort was like, there he is.
Yep.
You know, and, like, that made him feel... It made Voldemort feel some kind of emotion that then... Harry also tends to feel, because it seems like that's how it usually works.
Yeah.
Is Harry typically feels the scar hurt whenever Voldemort is feeling something strongly.
Right.
So that yeah, I don't know. I think that's pretty interesting. But it's a pretty, it's a pretty telling dream. You know, and of course, you know, you get a little bit of Malfoy in there, a little bit of Snape in there, both of whom like
throw you off a little.
Yeah, pretty much constant red herrings for the next five books where you're
until they aren't.
Until they aren't. And you finally get to be like, wow, Harry has only said it like 8 million times and now he finally got to be right.
Yep.
But yeah, so that's sort of like what it closes it out on. I feel like I relate to this dream because I feel like I have dreams like this constantly where it's just like a total amalgamation of my day's events.
Right.
Sort of like all morphing into this weird blob of like connective, like, why am I having all of these different people in the same room at the same time? And it's like, because they were all stressful things that happened inside of your day and they're all sort of like coalesced into this weird jelly of brain thought.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway.
Jelly of brain thought.
Oh yeah. So anyway, when I read that, I'm like, I've had this dream before. Not quite literally, but pretty close.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that is chapter 7.
That's chapter 7. Yeah, a lot happens.
It's a pretty cool chapter. I feel like I have really enjoyed this one. There's so much that we were able to unpack overall from it. So
yeah, I mean it's a very important chapter, Harry getting sorted, and like the ramifications of this night are like set up most of book 2.
Yes. Yep, absolutely.
So I do have a review.
Oh, lay it on me.
For the day. This is from Everywhere Adam, who says, hey, brother, and then four fire emojis. This is a short one. It just says, I've loved the Harry Potter series for 26 years. The Carlin brothers are my only source for deep dives into the wizard world.
Oh, that's so cool.
Thanks, Everywhere Adam.
I love that. Yeah, thank you so much, Adam, for leaving a review. As ever, if you would like to leave a review on the podcast, it certainly helps us out a lot and some discoverability, and we might just read your review here on the pod.
Especially if you're reviewing from Sweden.
As just a gentle reminder.
Gentle reminder. We want to get back at number one, okay?
We want to be back in your good books.
Yeah, back in your good books. Let's do it.
You get it? Your good books?
I get it. Yeah.
It was incredibly clever. As
yes,
you
yeah. no doubt.
Yeah, no doubt. Anyway, but guys, I think that is all for this week.
Yeah, join us next week for Chapter 8, The Potions Master Through the Gryffindor.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.